Good afternoon. Who has read Harry Potter here? Anyone read Harry Potter? Yeah, good. There's outlines at the back, by the way. So we have like two, three people who read Harry Potter, read all the four. Who has heard of Harry Potter? Just about everyone. Just about everyone. Harry Potter is a phenomenon of a book basically about a boy who is raised in a muggle family. That means a family of people who are not wizards, but he really is a wizard. And the wizards seek him out and take him to a wizard school, Hogwarts School for Wizards, where he attends high school, junior high, so six years of high school in England, which is where Hogwarts is. And the entire book is about the adventures of this Harry Potter and his learning wizardry and witchcraft and the existence of an entire parallel society of wizards and witches who live in the same country, but in a different dimension. So, obviously, the first thing that strikes a Jew when they read Harry Potter is that, is the parallel dimension idea of living. Type of like Jews, to a certain degree, have been living on the same planet but in a different world for thousands of years. Okay. We have our little wizardry, we have our Torah, we have our unique rules and our unique lifestyle, and there's a magic to it which is incredible, which is eternal. And the rest of the world looks at us and they also realize that we're not exactly in the same planet. Richard Wagner, in his essay, Jury in Music, writes that there is something foreign about a Jew, no matter which country he is from. Something foreign about us. When I'm on the plane and I'm traveling, if I hear an Australian accent, I usually will go over and say, "Hi, g'day, I'm Australian too." And they look at me, the yarmulke, the beard, the tzitzis, and they look at me as if I just said to them, "Hi, I'm from Alpha Centauri." They're like, you know, I feel like a conehead, right? You know, the coneheads in Saturday Night Live. "Where are you from?" "I'm from Paris, France," right? That's it. Yes. But of course, you're a different dimension, different planet. So in a way, you know, some people, a good friend of mine read Harry Potter, and that's the first thing that hit him. We're the wizards living in a parallel world, right? With this hole in the wall that materializes to go into the shopping alley, you know, like, so you're in a city and the non-Jews don't necessarily even know, but you know, you've got this like store for Sapphorus and there's a store for Sforium and there's a kosher food store and there's all this stuff. They have no idea. And we go in and buy our really strange things, you know, I'd like a pair of tefillin, you know what I mean? And we're looking for the specific, you know, the unicorn hair coming out of it, like the wand and that type of stuff. And we're buying all these bizarre things. And to a certain degree, as Jews, we can identify with that. There are others who see in it an analogy to the exile. Right? The Harry Potter assimilated wizard living in a family of muggles. Muggles is the term for people who do not know magic. And he is sought out by the wizards and who bring him close, so to speak, and bring him back into the fold, which is something which we can relate to. Certainly at a Gateway seminar, we can relate to the idea of sparks of Jews in different places who are coming together into Judaism. But I don't want to talk about any of that because I think that's not what the author had in mind, number one. Number two, we have plenty of our own literature that describes exile, that describes Judaism and the Jewish nature in much better detail, much more accurately, and much more beautifully than Harry Potter novels do, and therefore I don't really like to do that, and I'm not going to talk about that. What I want to talk about really is the central theme of the books, and which is something that is certainly in the 90s and in the 2000s, surprisingly enough, with all our technology and with all our advancements in science, people are getting very into lots of weird things. People are getting into lots of occult practices. The whole of the New Age culture, I mean, I hesitate to call it culture, but a lot of the New Age stuff, right? You know, power of crystals and pyramids and colored lights and all this type of drivel. to a great degree, a lot of it is very much a type of like belief in witchcraft and superstition and magic, etc., etc. People still read horoscopes. People still do things which are avoid, you know, black cat crosses your path, oh no, etc., etc. So, and in fact, the Torah tells us, number one, do not follow the ways of Egypt where you once lived, nor of Canaan where I'll be bringing you. Do not follow any of their customs. Safeguard all my decrees and laws and keep them, so the land to which I am bringing you to settle will not vomit you out. Do not follow the customs of the nations I am driving out before you, since they did all the above-mentioned perversions and I was disgusted with them. God tells us that the Jews are coming from Egypt to Canaan. They are both societies that were permeated with paganism, permeated with belief in many types of witchcraft and witchcraft activities. And God is telling us, don't look back to where you came from, don't look where you're going to. Look up to where the Torah came from heaven, and that is what you have to follow. Because these are specifically the practices I am taking you out from. He's destroying the Canaanites, he took us out of Egypt, and we are supposed to be separate from that type of idea. And in this week's portion, in the Torah portion we just read yesterday, the Torah tells us, when you come to the land that God your Lord is giving you, do not learn to do the revolting practices of the nations. There shall not be found anyone who passes his son or daughter through fire. There is a matter of controversy what that meant. That was the worship of Moloch. Some commentaries say that what it actually meant was child sacrifice. And there's a valley just outside Jerusalem. As you come from the old city in the direction of Talpiot, and you look down to the valley in between, it's called Gei Hinnom. Gei means a valley, Hinnom, the valley of Hinnom. And that was a place where the worship of Moloch was practiced and child sacrifice. Hence, the Hebrew word Gehinnom, meaning hell, as is being described very accurately by what went on in that valley. Others say, however, what it meant was it was an initiation ceremony. There were two fires and the child just passed and walked in between them as of initiating him into the cult of Moloch. Anyone who practices stick divination, people who would throw sticks on the ground, whichever way the stick pointed, they would say, that's the way I'm supposed to go. Right? Very similar to people who find water, what's that called? Dowsing. So that type of stuff. Or who divines auspicious times, that would be astrology, horoscopes. Who divines by omens. Omens, in other words, I saw a red moon tonight. Hey, of course, he forgot to remove his pink sunglasses, but he saw a red moon tonight, or I saw a comet, or I saw this, or a black cat, all this type of stuff. Who practices witchcraft, very broad. Witchcraft meaning the incantations, right? Whether it be stupefy or abracadabra or whatever it happens to be, incantations and spells and magic potions, things like that. Who consults mediums and oracles, and who attempts to communicate with the dead. The Canaanites used to do this. There are people today who do this. You know, it was quite famous, the Harry Houdini. Spent years and years trying to communicate with his dead mother through mediums, and since he knew all about the tricks and sleight of hand, he was able to expose many, many mediums who are all fakes. There's a magician by the name of, I think it's Randy, the Magnificent Randy, who is a member of the Skeptics Society of America. They have a magazine, the Skeptics Magazine, in which they have a standing bet of $50,000 to anyone who can prove to them a supernatural phenomenon. Basically, it's scientists and a number of magicians, and no one has yet got the money. Most people who claim to be witches today are not witches. The covens of witches at various colleges. I think my wife told me that at Bryn Mawr College in Pennsylvania, which she attended, there was a coven of witches. What do they say? Liberal arts and chemistry? Right. Who knows? Right. But these people, I mean, the wearing of a black robe and the mixing of lizard's tails, eye of a newt, and liver of a blaspheming Jew does not a witch make. Right. This despite Shakespeare. Right. But, again, mediums and oracles, etc. Anyone who is involved in these practices is repulsive to God. And it was because of repulsive practices such as these that God your Lord is driving these nations out before you. You must therefore remain totally faithful to God your Lord. Tamim to hear im Hashem Elokecha, totally faithful. The nations you are driving out listen to astrologers and stick diviners. What God has given you is totally different. God will set up a prophet like me amongst your brethren, and it's to him you must listen. The basic commandment of Tamim Tihyeh, which means, Tamim means to be completely, totally faithful to God. And that commandment means that we don't listen to predictions about the future. The truth is, even if it would be not a witch or a wizard, but someone who claims to be a Kabbalist, for example, there was an amazing story which happened in which a fellow who was studying at Ponovitch Yeshiva, a very famous yeshiva in Bnei Brak in Israel. It's actually one of the largest and most prestigious yeshivas in the world. I think Rabbi Sushad studied there. And so now it's not as prestigious because he left, but it's a very good place. And there was a student there who got engaged. And a friend of his said, you know what, there's a Kabbalist, a mystic, who can look at your name and the name of your fiancé and tell you lots of interesting stuff. So the guy said, okay. And he says, and it's very essential. If you don't do it, who knows what could happen? So he took the name, his name, and the name of his fiancée to the Kabbalist. I think maybe his friend took it. And the Kabbalist said, it will be disastrous. Do not get married. It will be tragic, disastrous, horrific. The name, absolutely, absolutely don't do it. So this guy, of course, on the eve of his wedding, a few weeks before the wedding, he was distraught. He went to Rav Shach, who was the Rosh Yeshiva, head of the Yeshiva at Ponovitch. And Rav Shach said to him, give me the note from the Kabbalist. He gives it to him and says, rips it up. He says, bunch of rubbish. Poppycock and hoddlewash. Gobbledygook. Right? He says, the Torah tells us, Tamim Tihyeh, be completely faithful to God. That means, the way I conduct my life are through the rules that the Torah gave me and through the knowledge that God gave us. It is not through trying to circumvent this. It is not through trying to figure out the future and the divination of names, etc., whether it be a religious Jew who's doing it with a beard who claims he's a Kabbalist, or whether it be a witch from Bryn Mawr doing it, or whether it be whoever it happens to be, right? It doesn't, or Eastwick, it doesn't matter, right? What matters is that you've got rules that we have to follow. There's another story, and Rav Shach told him this. He says, go ahead with the wedding, ignore what he says. If, according to the Torah, you have found a woman that you are attracted to, and you get on well with, and she is God-fearing and has good character traits, and that's it. You've fulfilled your obligations to look any further, to try and figure out, read the palm, read the forehead, right, to look at the names, forget it. Forget it. And there's a story told in the Talmud. We discussed in the archaeology class, Chizkiah, king of Jerusalem. Chizkiah was lying in bed, sick, and he was besieged. The city of Jerusalem was besieged by the Assyrian army, massive Assyrian army, 180,000 officers alone in the army. And he was lying in bed sick. The prophet Isaiah comes to Chizkiah to visit him. So instead of coming and says, how are you feeling? Refuah Shleima. The prophet says to Chizkiah, you are going to die and you're not going to live. And Chizkiah says, what do you mean? He says, you'll die in this world and you won't live in the world to come. Imagine getting a visit from a prophet. I mean, it's not just the doctor, right? It's the prophet coming in, right? And telling you this. So Chizkiah says, what did I do? There's nothing. I didn't do anything. He says that. That's right. It's what you didn't do that you're being punished for. He says, what didn't I do? Prophet says, you didn't have children. You did not engage in procreation. So Chizkiah has got a good excuse. First of all, I should point out, Jerusalem was under siege. The land of Israel was in a state of famine. There was an invading army surrounding the walls of Jerusalem. Okay? And Chizkiah was also sick. And the prophet's telling him that he should be engaged in procreation, have children. But Chizkiah's excuse was none of that. Chizkiah had a better excuse. He said, Chizkiah also had prophecy. Chizkiah said, I saw with prophecy that my son would be evil. Evil. I don't just mean Macaulay Culkin type evil, right? I mean my son will be an evil, idol-worshipping, murderous dictator, right? He will be sick and evil, right? That's who my son will be. So, of course, I didn't want to have a kid. So the prophet did not come along and say, that's a good point. That's not what the prophet said. The prophet said the following, the calculations of God are not for you to worry about. Do what you were commanded. The calculations of God are for God. That's God's problem. It's God's problem. Right? He commanded you to do X, Y, and Z. Right? If I do X, Y, and Z, there's going to be some negative outcomes. Guess whose problem that is? His. So, in other words, Chizkiah made a mistake. The mistake was that even though he had prophecy, he should not have looked into the future and said and evaded his responsibility. No, on the contrary. Right? God wants us to be completely faithful to the Torah and to God, and it doesn't matter what we see through divination or prophecy. Tamim tihyeh means completely and totally faithful. And therefore, the Torah prohibited all types of divination and witchcraft, etc., etc. Now, the question which I think is more significant is, but does this stuff actually work? True, the Torah prohibits it. The Torah does prohibit witchcraft. The Torah prohibits divination. The Torah does prohibit these things. Does the Torah prohibit them because they are foolish? Does it prohibit them because they are going to lead us away from the ways of the Torah, on the one hand, but really these things do not work? Or do these things really work, but the Torah prohibits them anyway because they are evil? Is there some type of power in the world which a witch can use? Is there actually magic which people can avoid and which people can circumvent the laws of nature in the world? Is there such a thing? Apparently, on the surface, this is a major dispute between two of the greatest Jewish sages that ever lived, Maimonides and Nachmanides. Maimonides, number four, in a number of places, repeats this, one of his responsa in his commentary on Avodah Zarah, and also here. He says the following: all these matters are falsehood and deception. They were used by idolaters to deceive the common people in order to gain their loyalty. It is not fitting for Israelites who are intellectuals to follow these vanities or even think that there is benefit in them. Maimonides says these were all ways which it was sleight of hand. Sometimes idolaters used their scientific knowledge to gain power over people. One example given by the commentaries is very simple. The Egyptians, one of the gods the Egyptians worshipped was Ra, the sun god. So the Egyptians had a knowledge of astronomy, the priests at least, but they didn't teach astronomy in the schools in Egypt. So what would happen is the priest would get up and say, "I want your money." And people would say, "Oh, I'll give him money." Oh, yeah, of course. So he says, "If you don't give me 20% of your money, then Ra will be exceedingly angry. And next Tuesday morning at 10:35, he'll blink and the world will go dark in the middle of the day." And they all say, "Ooh," right? And he's predicting an eclipse. So what would happen is Tuesday morning, so some people would give him money, some people wouldn't. 10:35, Tuesday morning, it goes dark, right? And everyone's like, he was right. Everyone rushes to the priest. So the people who gave him money, he says, obviously you did not give me enough. And the people who didn't give him, he'll say, "Well, give me the money," right? And of course, he'd have tremendous power. Now, that's why the Talmud says, by the way, if you know astronomy, it's a mitzvah to teach astronomy and to disseminate your knowledge of it. The Gemara in Shabbos, right? Why? One of the reasons for that is because now imagine if all the little Egyptian kids in fifth and sixth grade, you know, had the flashlight and the tennis balls and stuff like that and learnt about eclipses, right? How much power do you think the priest would have? He's like, "Next Tuesday morning, Ra will blink. It will go dark in the middle of the day." And all the little kids would say, "Oh, big deal. You know, you got the tennis ball, the flashlight. No, it's not Ra blinking. It's like the moon getting in front of the sun. Big deal. You know, apparent diameter of the moon is the same as that of the sun. It's just the moon's closer and it covers up the sun. Big deal." No power. So if you teach scientific knowledge, you are taking away from the power of these superstitious pagan priests, the magi. So Maimonides says, he says, this is their falsehood and deception. It is not fitting for us to believe them. One who thinks that these matters are true and have wisdom, but the Torah forbade them for various reasons, is a fool and lacks perception. Intellectuals and possessors of wisdom know with clear proofs that these things that the Torah forbade are not matters of wisdom, but are vanity and falsehood that fools followed. and abandoned the ways of truth as a result of them. Because of this, the Torah forbade them when it said, Tamim tihyeh, you must remain faithful to God your Lord. It seems very, very clear from Maimonides, both here and in other places, that all these matters are simply not true. They could not communicate with the dead. They were incapable of doing it. And they could not place spells upon people. And they could not, their potions were useless. And they did not know what was happening in the future. And all of this, he says, is vanity and falsehood. And we can understand why he said that. His reputation, Maimonides' reputation, he's always called by historians and scholars the great rationalist. Right? And in the Guide for the Perplexed, he offers rationale for all the commandments in section 3 without once resorting to anything which is beyond the natural world. Sociological, psychological, physical, medical, economic reasons for the commandments, but nothing that resorts to anything which is beyond. And it appears to fit in to Maimonides' general understanding of an explanation of many, many things. The Talmud, for instance, says that when a person goes out of their home in the morning and the man, let's say, is wearing tefillin and in, got a talus on and you touch the mezuzah, he is surrounded by angels. Maimonides, of course, explains in the end of the laws of mezuzah, angels are the positive force and spirituality created within you by your fulfillment of the commandments. There's not these little white things with wings, right, buzzing around next to you, right? That's not what he says. Okay, and that's his, that seems to be the trend. But there's a major problem, so that's Maimonides. That seems to be Maimonides' falsehood. Doesn't work. Bunch of rubbish. Why does the Torah prohibit it? It prohibits it because you're not supposed to engage in foolishness, A, and because B, it circumvents the laws of the Torah. It will lead you to mistakes like Chizkiah made, mistakes like this guy in Ponovitch made. It will lead you away from the laws of the Torah. We've already got a way to follow life. You don't need all this stuff. That's what Maimonides seems to say. You had a question?
Yeah. How can Maimonides say that? What about King Saul when he went to the magician and she brought up the dead? And Maimonides comes after the Navi was written. Is he refuting the validity of that experience, or does he interpret it in a different way?
It's an excellent question. What's your name, sir?
Menucha
asked that there's a story in the Tanakh in which Saul goes to a witch and the witch raises Samuel from the dead and King Saul speaks to Samuel. And how can Maimonides deny that? It's explicit in the Torah, the prophets, books of the prophets. It's impossible. Not only that, let me amplify your question. There are countless, literally hundreds of times in the Talmud that talks about supernatural things happening done through forces of impurity, through wizardry and witchcraft and magic, etc. Kishuf, the Gemara in Chulin says, why is Kishuf magic called Kishuf Shemachashashim Pamalia Shalmala? It's an acronym for those things that contradict the divine order of creation, the Talmud says. Maimonides is ignoring the Talmud. Maimonides is ignoring the books of the prophets. Maimonides is ignoring hundreds of cases in the Midrash. Very, very strange. It's a very good question. We're going to deal with that. We're going to do it a little bit later. We'll deal with it. But the problem with Maimonides is that how can he deny it? I mean, you know, it's interesting. If you read, there's a book called The Golden Bough. Has anyone read that? The Golden Bough? B-O-U-G-H. By Sir James Fraser. It is the most authoritative history of magic, superstition, witchcraft, and idolatry that exists. The complete version is about 12 volumes. I have the condensed version at home, one volume about 1,500 pages. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable, this book. Very fascinating, right? Beats Harry Potter, right? But it's a little hard to wade through, right? But again, you know, there seems to be an overwhelming amount of accounts in all societies, in all countries. People of all types of intelligence, very intelligent people, very learned people, who seem to talk about phenomenon which seem to be supernatural. Now, you have to be very careful here. What's supernatural to one person might be technology to another. You got some Australian prospector, drives up in his four-wheel drive Range Rover, right, in New Guinea somewhere or in Indonesia. He comes in on a Stone Age tribe, right, and he says, you know, he comes out of the truck and they're looking at this bizarre creature. I mean, they haven't seen anything. He comes out, he says, g'day, right? And they're saying, oh, what is this? And then he gets a call on his cellular and he's got a flashlight and they must freak out. In fact, anthropologists pointed out that after the Second World War, there's such a thing as cargo cults. You ever heard of cargo cults? In the Pacific Island, New Guinea and Pacific and many of the Pacific Islands, the United States during the Second World War dropped supplies to their soldiers fighting the Japanese. And very often, the supplies were dropped in places where the soldiers didn't get them. So there were many tribes in New Guinea and Pacific Islands who were, we call Stone Age tribes. That means they have never seen any technology. So they see this plane, they don't know what it is, and a crate drops out on a parachute and falls down near them. And this happened a lot of times. They'd like look at the crate, they may open it and find all these artifacts which are beyond imagination. They have no idea what they are. No idea what they are. So anthropologists found that after the Second World War, a number of these tribes had built effigies of the planes out of wood and crates and were worshipping them. And they're called the cargo cults. They worship cargo. They worship cargo. It's unbelievable. So because for them, this was totally supernatural. There was a movie, Gods Must Be Crazy, about some Australian natives. Some pilot throws a Coke bottle out of his plane, right? And they find the Coke bottle. And they look at this thing. I mean, an Australian Aborigine has never seen glass, a Coke bottle, right? And they figure it must be an artifact of the gods. It's a great movie, actually. Wasn't it good?
Right. I didn't see it.
You didn't see it? Okay. Right. Neither did I, actually. Anyway, so I read the reviews, though, and the reviews are all good. So... Truth is, I read reviews of all the movies. I just haven't seen. Okay. Anyway, but but that's really, you have to know what's magic, what's not. But there have been reports throughout the generations of things which indeed seem to be supernatural and of these phenomena. So that doesn't bother me so much because it's very, very hard to discern what's supernatural. I'm sure you've all heard of Clever Huns. Ever heard of Clever Huns? Clever Huns was a horse by the name of Huns, beginning of last century. And Clever Huns was able to do math. So they'd ask Huns, Huns, what's 10 plus 10? The Huns would go, stamp with his hoof, right, 20 times, and they'd stop at 20. And they'd ask him multiplication. Not long multiplication because he could be standing there for days while this horse, But I mean, he'd always get it right. I mean, not always, but his accuracy was something like over 85%. That's unbelievable. That's incredible. Okay? And eminent scientists of the time did not know what it was. There's a horse could do math. So, you know what happened? They finally figured out exactly what it was. The horse, and this is itself is amazing. It's not supernatural, but it is amazing. There's a book, I saw this in a book called Anomalistic Psychology, A Study of Magical Thinking. So the researchers, what they found in investigating Clever Huns was this. Huns could sense the tension and the changes in breathing of the people who were watching him as he came close to the correct number. Right? So when his trainer was in the room, whose body language he was most familiar with, when he came to 20, like the trainer would even, not even consciously, just go, he heard the inhale of breath, Huns would stop. And everyone would say, wow. And even when the trainer wasn't in the room, everyone else would get tense as he got close to the number to see, is he going to do it or not? Right? And he'd figure it out. Is that amazing? But that's not supernatural. It's not supernatural. Okay? And so many of these cases have been disproved in that way. I actually heard from Rav Weinbach, the Rosh Hashiva of Or Sameach. He says, unfortunately, in a lot of our schools, we train our children to be clever Huns. Right? We train them to interpret what it is the teacher wants and just give that out. Right? And that's it. But that's not education, he said. Another example was Bridie McMurphy. Heard of Bridie McMurphy? Bridie McMurphy was a woman who had never set foot in Ireland. Right? She grew up in the United States. But never set foot in Ireland. And she was able to recite Irish ballads and describe places in Ireland in great detail and speak Gaelic, apparently fluently, and never been to Ireland in her life. And it was believed that she was a reincarnation of some Irish nursemaid or milkmaid or something like that. Right? What was found out on investigation was that she had a nurse when she was an infant, 2-3 years old, who used to sing to her Irish ballads, speak Gaelic to her, and talk about her city in Ireland, her little village in Ireland. Somehow, and this is also amazing, although it's not supernatural, this child, when she was a little child, assimilated all this, and years and years later, she was able to do this. Right, so what is supernatural, what is not, is a very hard thing to determine. So it doesn't bother me that much that Maimonides, who is the supreme rationalist and scientist, would not bother him about all those reports and phenomena. Maimonides would not have been impressed by Clever Hans. He would have probably picked it up immediately. He would not have been impressed by Bridie McMurphy. He would not have been impressed by this. Okay. However, what does bother me is Manuka's question. What about Torah sources that indicate that these things are real? Torah sources. Maimonides cannot ignore that. Maimonides, after all, is there to comment on the Torah. That's what he is doing, conveying Torah. And the Torah itself, the oral and the written Torah, seem to say that these things do exist. Now, Nachmanides, before I answer Maimonides, I'd like to look at what Nachmanides says. Nachmanides says the following, and here is the major opponent of Maimonides in this famous argument. He says, number 3, no one understands that the Creator, who created this world ex nihilo from nothing, made the higher worlds rulers over the lower worlds. We believe there are many different levels of reality, many different, what we call different worlds. There is the God, of course. All of these worlds exist within God. This God encompasses all of reality. What's one of the names of God? Is Hamakom. What does Hamakom mean? Is that a strange name for God? The place? Right? The place. God is the place. So the Medrash says, the explanation is, Hu mekomo shel olam, ve'ein ha'olam mekomo. He is the place of the world is not his place. Reb Chaim Volozhin explains, Nefesh Chaim 1, that what this means is the following. He explains this. He says what it means is that place means the framework of existence of something. Like we would call it now probably something like space-time. The framework of existence. We exist within the framework of space-time. Makom. God does not exist within space-time. Space-time exists within God. The framework of God's existence is God. He doesn't have a framework of existence outside of himself. He is the framework of existence. Hu mekomo shel olam. He's the place of all of existence. Ein ha'olam mekomo. The world is not his place. Now, so we have, so to speak, God as the framework of existence. God is infinite. But the creation of a world meant a concealment of the divine presence. That concealment happened in stages. It doesn't go straight from the infinite to the finite, just like that. It wasn't that God's will propagated itself from the infinite, all-inclusive God to a finite world. There were steps. The steps are described, what are the steps described as in Ethics of the Fathers, describes the steps as, anyone know? It says, Be'asara ma'amarot nivra ha'olam. The world was created with 10 statements. Each one is a step down. A step down or away from the infinite reality of God. And each one of those till we get to our world. Each one of the statements of creation, which if you count up, including the word Genesis, as Dr. Goldfinger spoke about, that word Bereshit, each one of those is a statement of creation. 10 statements of creation. But each one is like a step down. Like type of, you know, you've got a power plant, New Jersey power plant belching pollution into the air near Newark Airport. You saw that, right? Everyone's seen that, right? So then you've got a substation somewhere, okay? And then you've got a transformer, and you've got a local power station, and then you've got your house electric circuits, and then you've got your PowerPoint, and then you've got a transformer, and then you can plug your Walkman in. You're not going to plug your Walkman directly into the power output of a nuclear reactor, are you? Right. This would not be good for the Walkman. Okay. Would not be good. Don't try this at home, please, children. Okay. So now, in the same way, there are step downs from God to this world. Each one is another world, another level of existence. He says, and this, he created natural orders and indications in these worlds that follow his will that are called nature. In all the various worlds, there are laws. Every world has laws. In this world, there are laws of nature, but in all the worlds, there are laws. Every world that God created, every level of spiritual reality, becoming less and less spiritual, more and more physical, everyone has rules and laws. And this is the secret of sorcery that contradicts the will of God and acts in opposition to the simple, plain powers, since they circumvent the divinely ordained structure of reality. For this reason, they were forbidden by the Torah. What this means is the following. Nachmanides is saying that if you could, theoretically, supposing you could somehow tap in to the laws of a higher world than this one. Now, the way it works is that every world affects the one below it, or the one within it. Okay, so let me try and give you a physical example of that. If I could somehow rearrange the molecules, because I had some type of physical device which I could point at this and rearrange the molecules so it became transparent. Or it became liquid. Or something like that. Okay, what I'd be doing really is, on the surface, our world, right, the surface world, right, this looks this way, right? You go a little deeper, you've got the molecular world. You change that around. Excuse me. Obviously, it's going to affect the external world. Now, if you could go, let's say, you'd go deeper than the molecular world and affect that, so that would affect the molecules, and that would affect the appearance of this lectern. Or if you went to a deeper level of reality and kept affecting it all the way down, you could affect changes in all of them. Maybe if you went down to the deepest level, what would you find if you went down to the deepest level? What would you find, Dr. Goldfinger? What would you find if you went down to the deepest level, below molecules, etc., etc.?
Tenure.
I like that. Right. There are different theories about it, right? There are superstring theories, right? There are all types of theories. Stephen Hawking, in one of his books, says the following. He says the deepest level of all is equations. Kitty, there's a book called The Fire in the Equations, and the author says, she quotes Stephen Hawking as saying, but what puts the fire into the equations that gives our world its meaning? He does not answer that. We answer that. We have an answer. You know what puts the fire into the equations that give our world its meaning? The Word of God. Bidvar Hashem Shamayim Na'asu. With the Word of God, the heavens were made. The Hebrew word for word is davar. The Hebrew word for object or thing is davar, because every thing or object is a manifestation of the divine word of creation. Now, manipulation of equations, if you could somehow do that, manipulation of the molecules, which you can do, manipulation of the divine words will have effects in the physical world, in our world. Those effects it will have is, to a certain degree, considered a circumvention of the laws of nature. It's Chizkiah looking into the future and not having a child, circumventing the biblical commandment because of whatever. It's the guy looking at the names and however he knew it, which he probably didn't because he was probably a charlatan, and saying this marriage won't work out. And it's a witch or a wizard or whatever it happens to be, somehow circumventing the natural laws, that is to say the laws of this world, and going into the laws of another world. There's two ways of getting access to other worlds of spirituality. We believe in a balance of power. During the Cold War, they used to call it mutually assured destruction. Right, that's what kept the peace. The fact that both the United States and the Soviet Union knew that each of them could destroy the entire world, what was it, 500,000-600,000 times over? I don't remember what it was, right? You know, of course, once you've already done it once, I'm not exactly sure what the advantage of having another 999 is. But let's say, right? But, you know, mutual destruction. You fire one at me, we have mutual destruction, balance of power. So this actually is a statement in Koheles. Book of Ecclesiastes says, Zeh l'umat zeh asa ha'elokim. One opposite the other did God make, meaning in order to have a world of free will, in order to have a world in which there is challenge, there has to be balanced out. What you can do through the forces of sanctity and good, you could also do through the opposite. Because if you could only do these amazing actions through the words of God found in the Torah, that would be an unbalanced world. You have to have a balance. It's very interesting. The Gaon of Vilna says in his commentary on Seder Olam that at the time where there were prophets amongst the Jewish people, he says the pagans also were given by God supernatural powers. Why do you think God would give pagans supernatural powers? And he...
To balance it out.
Now, the supernatural... Because imagine, you've got on the one hand Jeremiah, Isaiah, and Ezekiel. Aside from just reading the literature, it's amazing, beautiful, and deep. But they were also moral people of morality, great stature, and they could also predict the future and do miracles. And who do you have in opposition? Some total moron on Sunday morning television, right, who cannot cure any sickness, right, who basically cannot do a miracle, who cannot predict the future, and who's corrupt. Now, is that free will? You could choose. You could choose, it's type of like a boxing match. You know, you've got, all in fight. Yes, come to the fight tonight. We've got, in one corner, Jean-Claude Van Damme, weighing 250 pounds of solid muscle, martial arts expert. In the other corner we have Woody Allen. Not a fair fight. Not a fair fight. Right? So in the, so that's what you'd have. You'd have Jeremiah in one corner and you'd have, Jimmy and Tammy Baker in the other corner, right? You know, to have a random example of corrupt morons, right? So you've got these two, okay? You got this, right? So that would be the situation. So there's a balance. That means you can reach things through Kedusha, sanctity, but the same things, because of the balance of power, Zelu Umat Zeh, can also be reached through the forces of Tuma, of impurity. So Nachmanides is saying that what it means is if you're able to link into the higher worlds, which you can do through sanctity and through the Torah, and through the knowledge of the names of God and the knowledge of the words of God that created the world, that means there must also be the possibility of accessing it through the illegal route, through the illicit route, through the Tumah. That, he says, is witchcraft. And that's what's forbidden by the Torah. For the will of God is that we conduct ourselves in this world according to natural laws, which are His will. And God forbade these things and all matters of divination, as the verse says. He gave us something superior to the nations. He will place among us a prophet. He will put His words into the prophet's mouth. You will obey Him and not have any need for sorcerers and necromancers. So, Nachmanides is saying that yes, it's a reality. These things are a reality. These things are a reality in which you are accessing different worlds, spiritual worlds, and the spiritual world's impact on the physical worlds. As I mentioned yesterday, the dream of Jacob, and he sees the angels going up and down the ladder, and the famous question which Rashi points out, which is, angels should be going down and then up. Angels originate in heaven. They should be going down the ladder and going up. Jacob sees a vision of angels going up and then down. Rashi gives two answers. Rav Moshe Chaim Lozato gives a third. Rav Moshe Chaim Lozato says, angels means the messages that are being created by human free will and human action. And he says, what is the origin of events in this world? God created the world because of free will as a closed system. He wants everything to come from within us. So that means I make a free will decision that sends an angel up the ladder. God then reacts and it creates a ripple effect in all the worlds, my action, and then that creates a ripple effect coming down the ladder, almost like a reflected waves coming back down the ladder, in which that now has an impact on what happens in this world. So therefore, you can either send angels up the ladder through your good actions, or theoretically, the opposite. That's what Nachmanides is saying. That's what's prohibited. Now, this then is the very famous argument between Nachmanides and between Maimonides. Maimonides telling us anyone with a brain in their head will realize it's a bunch of rubbish. It's deception, it's sleight of hand, it's foolishness. Intellectuals should not believe this. We should not accept it. You should be skeptical about it. The Torah prohibits it, not because it really works, but because it's stupid and it circumvents the laws of the Torah, which we have to follow. Be completely faithful to God. Nachmanides says, no. He says, these things are real. True. most people who claim to have them are charlatans, both on the Jewish side and on the non-Jewish side. Most people who claim to be Kabbalists and can do this and that, wear my cloak, etc., charlatans, frauds. And most people who claim to be witches and wizards, charlatans and frauds. Right? The guy with the fluorescent signs in the window, tarot cards read, $5, that type of stuff, guaranteed is a fraud. However, it is not to say these things don't exist. They really do exist. And there appears to be two problems here. One is, this seems to be a massive, very extreme argument from one end to the other. A, and B, our question from before, which is, Maimonides is contradicting hundreds, literally hundreds of references in the Talmud, the Midrash and the Zohar, and also contradicting explicit verses in the prophets. How do we resolve this? So I would like to offer the explanation I heard from my Rebbe, Ramosha Shapiro, and how he understands this. And what he said, and when he first said it to me, I just could not accept it. I was shocked by it. He said, there is no argument between Maimonides and Nachmanides. I said, well, read the words. He says he knows the words by heart. He doesn't have to read, right? So I couldn't accept it. There's no argument. But he says, it really depends on what you mean when you say the word reality or not. What does it mean something is real or true, for that matter? What we mean is this. What do we mean when we say something's true? Well, for example, supposing in this room we all agreed that 2 plus 2 equals 5. Okay? We all come to an agreement. We all vote 2 plus 2 equals 5. We all believe 2 plus 2 equals 5. Does 2 plus 2 equal 5? In reality? No. Right? But we all believe that it's 2 plus 2 equals 5. So that is something which is not true. What do you mean by not true? That means that outside of our minds, it doesn't exist. If we would all cease to believe it, it would stop to exist. 2 plus 2 equals 4, that exists out independent of whether we believe in it or not. Correct? Right? That's how Maimonides defines truth in the beginning of his book Mishneh Torah. There's a verse that says, Hashem Elohim Emet, God is true. What do we mean by God is true? What we mean is that he doesn't care whether atheists or agnostics believe or doubt or not, right? He exists independent of us. He exists independent of our minds. He exists independent of our belief. He exists independent of the world. He exists independent of space-time. He is the only true existence. Everything else is predicated. Everything else does not exist in that same way. So, let's go back to our analogy. 2 plus 2 equals 5 is not real. And it does not exist independent of our minds. But supposing we were all totally convinced that it was so, would that have any impact on our lives? I would say so. First of all, you'd fail elementary school. Again and again. Right? You'd be in grade 2 forever. This could have some impact on your life. Right? Secondly, you would not understand Sesame Street. Right? What are they called? Teletubbies. Because even if you thought 2 plus 2 equals 5, it would still be perfectly lucid. Right? So, you don't understand that, right? But it would deeply affect your life. You go to the store and expect a certain amount of change. As far as you're concerned, everyone's ripping you off, which in my case is probably true. But in general, right, they're not, you know. So if you went around with a belief that 2 plus 2 is 5, it would severely affect your life, wouldn't it? Would it affect other people's lives? Of course. It would affect your family and your friends and your business, and who knows what ripple effect it could have if you had a group of people who are utterly and totally convinced that 2 plus 2 equals 5. In other words, it would be real. 2 plus 2 equals 5 would be a reality, not a true reality, a false reality, but a reality that exists and that affects us and affects others and can affect life. So Nachmanides, will both say that, you see, the reality of evil and falsehood is not a real reality. What I mean by that? Independent of the human ability and propensity to do evil, evil doesn't exist. If you wouldn't have humans or free will, there would be no evil. Because everything ultimately is the will of God. And God is unified and true and one. Nothing exists that is against the will of God. But we know that evil carries on in the world. Who creates evil? Evil is 2 + 2 = 5. Evil and falsehood is 2, but we create it. We create evil. It's a reality that exists only within our universe. As you know, if you get to the higher levels of creation, the higher worlds, there will be no evil, there will be no free will, there will be nothing but God. As you get further and further away from that world of Ein Sof, of infinite, you get to worlds in which there's more concealment. And if there's more concealment, it's possible for people to believe that 2 + 2 = 5, or that it's okay to steal, or this or whatever it happens to be. Right? Whatever false reality people believe in. So we actually create evil. We create falsehood. And when we create falsehood and evil, it has an impact. It definitely has an impact. It has an impact on ourselves, has an impact on others, and has an impact on the world. Maimonides is telling me what the ultimate truth is. By the Maimonidean criteria of and definition of truth, magic, wizardry, the occult, are all false. They're not true. What does that mean? They don't exist outside of the minds and of the reality that people who believe in them have created. It doesn't really exist. It doesn't exist in the sense of Maimonidean truth. This is clear. Because Maimonidean truth is that which is true is that which exists independent of human free will, human vagaries, human belief, human doubt. And there's only one thing that does that. God and the Torah. So, that's what Maimonides is saying. Does this mean, however, that a false reality cannot have an impact? No. Nachmanides is talking about the reality that we live in. And the world and the reality that we live in is a world in which we have created falsehood. We have created our environment and we have to live in it and it affects us and it affects others and it can have an impact. But it's false. But falsehood has an impact. So they're not really disagreeing. They're not really disagreeing. They are talking about two different levels of truth and two different levels of reality. Nachmanides is talking about on the pragmatic, actual impact level of reality. And he's saying, yes, these things can have an impact. Why? Because we have created that evil within us and created that evil in the world. And now it has got power by virtue of the human beings giving it that power. And it can have an impact. However, Maimonides is saying, but it is not true. It is not true. It's falsehood. It only exists because people have given it that. It only exists in our minds. But unfortunately, things that exist in our minds can have an impact. And they can have an impact positively or negatively. And they do have that impact. That's how Maimonides understands it. And that's how Nachmanides would agree with him. So really, Maimonides is not disagreeing with any of the statements in the Talmud and with any of the statements in the Torah. He is not saying that it won't happen and it never did happen. He's saying that it happened to those people who are on the level where they believe that it happens and that have accepted as reality. What if you had a person who is an exception to most of mankind? What if you had a person who said that who lives on a plane where he lives on a plane of the Maimonidean truth? Very few and far between, I think. How many people really would live on such a plane? Very few. The Talmud says, Reb Chanina ben Dosa did. Right? There were a number of rabbis who did. There was a story of there was a witch in Babylon. She was following a rabbi and she was taking soil out of the ground that he stepped on. I checked up in Sir James Fraser, The Golden Bough. It is very common in witchcraft that if you get soil from the footprints of the person you want to curse, you're able to curse them. That was a common practice. So she's getting soil and she's doing it very surreptitiously so he doesn't notice. And he sees her, and he keeps on walking. And like, she's a little upset. Aren't you worried? I've got the soil from you. He says, why? Ein od milvado. He quotes a verse. There is nothing but God. Nothing but God. Wasn't worried. because he lived on a level of reality in which he understood there is nothing, nothing but God. So for those who live on that level of reality, then they're on a different plane. They're in a different planet. They're in a parallel universe which is not affected by wizardry, not affected by the magic. But those people are few and far between. And for most people, it can have an impact. Because most people don't have that realization that there's nothing but God. If you had that realization, we wouldn't be scared of anything. There's a beautiful story told about what they call the Friedeker Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe that preceded the one that was just recently died. So he was in prison in Russia. KGB had him in prison, and they were trying to get him to inform on other people who were teaching Torah, which was illegal at the time. So they tried for days and days to pressure him in all different ways. Nothing worked. Finally, in exasperation, the KGB person who was interrogating him pulled his pistol out, cocked it, held it to his head, and was squeezing the trigger in frustration. And the Rebbe laughed. He said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Little toy that you've got doesn't bother me." And he said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Look." He says, "If this world was the real world and you were going to take me out of the real world into a world of falsehood, I'd be worried." He says, "Okay, you shoot me, I'll be going into the world of truth and leaving this stupid prison and Soviet Union and this world of falsehood that you've created, and I'll be going into a better existence. Doesn't bother me." Put the gun away, he was released very soon afterwards. So he lived on a different plane of existence. It didn't bother him. And that's really what Maimonides is saying. Maimonides is saying, what does the Torah expect of us? It expects of us to be on the plane of existence that all there is God and his will. But the Torah acknowledges that we're not all on that level. And consequently, the Torah has prohibitions against engaging in these practices, because these practices encourage the belief in this false reality and create the false reality, and the false reality affects us and impinges on us and can hurt. And that's why the Torah prohibited them, and that's what Nachmanides would agree with as well. That's really the essence of what I wanted to give over. The argument of Maimonides and Nachmanides is not really an argument. We're just talking about two different levels of truth. And whether Harry Potter or not should be thrown out of Hebrew school, as long as you know, as Maimonides says, that the falsehood is falsehood, then you're not telling a lie. It's got to be clear in our minds what's false and what's true. If I tell you I'm about to tell you a lie, and then I tell you the lie, did I tell a lie or not? No. So if you read Harry Potter, know ahead of time that Maimonides says there's falsehood. Nachmanides says it can have an impact, but they would probably both agree that Hogwarts School of Magic and Harry Potter don't exist, right? Be that as it may, right, what our job is, tamim tihyem Hashem Elokecha, to be totally faithful to God and to recognize that the only true reality is that which exists independent of our free will and our evil, and that's the will of Hashem. Thank you very much.